Welcome to the Full of Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 9:10 British Summer Time. Today is August 24th. Today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. First, let's have a review of what's been happening this week. It's been an eventful week, particularly in precious metals. But first, let's have a look at the equity markets. And we've had a spectacular rally across a number of markets over the last couple of months. Short-term overbought conditions are evident across a range of markets, and this week we saw a certain number of those pull back. The Dow Jones is probably representative. The industrial average formed a downside key reversal, I think it was on Monday, pulled back for four consecutive days, found support today in the region of 13,000, and finished up on the day approximately 100 points. And that undid almost all of yesterday's decline. What it does suggest is that what we're seeing is an unwind of a short-term overbought condition rather than a reversal that some perhaps are anticipating. The oil market is also of particular interest because Brent crude has, having been as low as into the 80s dollar region in May and June, has rebounded strongly and got right back up towards the $120 area. It's finishing out the week on a weak note. And here also there is a short-term overbought condition evident and at least short-term capacity for a consolidation at a minimum in the region, or at least below this area of previous resistance. In the precious metal markets, platinum has rallied for, I think, six consecutive days. It's down very slightly in here today at $1,549. It's rallied by approximately $150, so given today's price, approximately 10%. Over the last week to 10 days. That is as a result of the rather tight condition within the market and the reliance of platinum on South African production, which has been plagued recently by worker unrest and some very tragic circumstances in violence between various differing labor unions and the police. In the industrial metal sector, we've seen that the majority of these industrial metals had pulled back rather sharply over the last few months. They have come back to the region of previous support in a number of cases. Tin has a certain amount in common with the platinum market in that a significant number of the smelters in Indonesia have been closed down because of the unprofitable nature of the operations, given the decline in prices. It is notable that with tin, current prices are approximately three times higher than they were prior to the initiation of the current decade-long bull market. And yet, these mines have experienced such an inflation in terms of their cost of production that they are no longer viable. And tin, in common with platinum, platinum is reliant on South African production, and tin is very much reliant on Indonesian and Malaysian production. Well, it's rallied spectacularly in the last few days. It's broken the six-month progression of lower rally highs, and when one looks at the five-year chart, one can see that significant upward dynamics following pullbacks has been really quite a reliable indicator. It does suggest that prices are going to go higher from here. Because of that tight situation, tin has in previous cycles been a leader for the industrial metal complex, so it can probably be looked on as a bullish characteristic for a sector that has really been beaten down over the last number of months. In the grain and bean complex, corn is steady above the $8 area. Wheat is 12 cents below $9, and soybeans hit another new high in here this week. This remains a very weather-driven environment, and until we see a substantial break in the drought for the USA, then there is going to be continued upward pressure on these soft commodities. We are starting, though, to get to a position where demand destruction can start to creep in. So the volatility that has crept into this market does suggest that the risk premium has also increased substantially in this market, and the volatility is likely to continue to increase as well. It's become a much more dangerous environment. In the currency markets, the euro is back up to $1.25. It's rallied rather impressively over the last number of months. Well, I suppose 6 weeks is probably a bit more accurate. It's at least partially unwound its oversold condition relative to the 200-day moving average. Where it goes from here is going to be the big question. And the Eurozone's crisis hasn't just gone away. There are still some serious questions that need to be asked and answered. And what has begun to unfold over the last week or two is that you're getting politicians coming back from holiday, and they're beginning to sound a more dovish note about cohesion. And we are into a phase where there is going to have to be some significant political leadership evolve within Europe. The ECB has been doing everything in its power to provide the market with liquidity and ensure that there wasn't going to be a rerun of what happened in August of last year when we had a big dislocation in the markets. The Eurozone's TED spread, which is the spread between the 3-month Euro LIBOR and 3-month government bond, German government bond paper, has continued to contract, which would suggest that the ECB is making abundant liquidity available. Spanish 2-year yields have contracted substantially over the last few months, over the last few weeks since the end of July. The Irish government bond got below 6% in here this week. So we are seeing that investors are beginning to take a little bit more of a dovish tone towards the Eurozone. That is also reflected in the stock market. The Eurozone stock market has had a particularly impressive rally over the last few weeks. Short-term overbought conditions are also evident here. They went up fastest. They have had some of the biggest pullbacks in here this week. But given the fact that there is this more dovish tone, it does suggest that what we are more likely to see is a consolidation, and that there is still potential upside for a number of these markets. What is perhaps the greatest risk to the bullish scenario is the oil price. And while it looks primed for at least a consolidation, it needs to come back down before people can really have, or at least before it will no longer represent a headwind for global economic growth. If we take a step back and we look at where monetary policy is on a global footing, then China has so far been rather tentative in its supports for its markets. It has given the banking sector greater leeway to set deposit and interest rates. It's been lowering the transaction tax, and it has not really let up on the pressure that it is putting on the housing sector. What it has also done is allowed the renminbi to weaken somewhat over the last number of months, and when one looks at the dollar, it has been ranging now above the 200-day moving average against the renminbi for the last couple of months, and it would really need to sustain a move back below the MA to question potential for some additional upside by the dollar over the medium term. Perhaps the most contrarian call in the markets at present would be to be bullish of the US dollar, not just over the short term, but over the medium term. When one looks at very long-term charts of, for example, the dollar index, then one could compare the dollar to an oil tanker, because it takes a very long time to turn. We've seen that the dollar index is in the region of the 80 to 90 area and has been for a significant amount of time, at least the last few years. And what preceded this range was an almost decade-long decline. And what we're now starting to see is potentially base formation development. And that's an interesting scenario from a long-term perspective. In the short term, there are still significant headwinds for the US economy. The so-called fiscal cliff, the unfunded liabilities in the form of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid all need to be dealt with, and I don't envy the whoever becomes the next president some of the decisions that they're going to have to make. But at the same time, the USA has adopted a more thorough auditing of its banking sector and moved quickly to recapitalize the banking sector. It is notable that in the last few weeks, the S&P 500 Banks Index has been ranging in a rather tight fashion in the region of the upper side of the three-year base. And in the absence of clear downward dynamics, one would have to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. David posted an interesting article earlier this week about robotics. And robotics and the companies that build these robots for factory automation really does have the potential to create value, and something that all major bull markets thrive on is productivity efficiencies. That was the, regardless of what the promises were for the Nasdaq bubble, it was productivity efficiencies that were introduced by the introduction of the internet that really helped to drive a major bull market. And during the Japanese bull market, it was not so much the fact that the Imperial Palace was considered to be worth more than the entire state of California that was driving the market, but it was the automation and management practices that were creating productivity efficiencies that helped to drive that major bull market. China's major bull market has been going on for at least the last 20 years. It was, I suppose, enabled by massive infrastructure development, and infrastructure development on a per capita or on a percentage of GDP basis that hasn't been seen at any point in history. But what it allowed corporations to do was to increase productivity by accessing a practically limitless labor force at an incredibly low price. Cloud computing, it has been the most recent productivity gain, and really does is an incredible example of just what can be achieved in an online capacity. But factory automation is probably the next big thing in that regard. If you can spend X amount of money and displace a large proportion of one's costs, then that introduces productivity efficiencies that can go into creating not only more products, but more complex products, and bring down the price of those products to the end consumer. The challenge, of course, for various governments is to manage the potential for widespread unemployment as a result of this trend. But what we can say practically from, well, really from a very confident perspective, is that if the efficiencies are there and there is profit to be made in a capitalist society, that is the way that we're going to go. So rather than attempt to fight this type of development, it would be better to accept it and to benefit from it. I reviewed a number of factory automation, David reviewed a number of factory automation companies earlier this week, and the number of companies involved in that sector is likely to increase substantially as we move forward. When one removes the labor cost coefficient from the productivity equation, then one moves on to the cost of energy. And in that regard, the USA has a distinct advantage. The release of unconventional oil and gas reserves has created this impressive spread between Brent crude and West Texas Intermediate. That isn't something that is likely to evaporate overnight. In fact, the USA is only likely to increase its production of unconventional oil and gas. It's looking increasingly likely that there's going to be a migration over to increased use of natural gas as a transportation fuel. And if the country plays its cards right, then there is really the potential to become energy independent. Now, in an environment where you have factory automation leveling the playing field in terms of labor costs, then low energy costs to drive those machines really does become a deciding factor. And whereas a number of emerging markets have historically benefited from their low labor costs, they have classically been uncompetitive in the cost of energy. And that is a real advantage for energy-rich countries. So this is likely to be a significant factor in the development of the global economy over the next 20 years. The fact that we are now starting to see a supply response to high prices being sustained over a number of years is not bullish for oil. Whereas what we've seen over the last few years is that investors have been worried about the way that governments have been increasing the supply of money, and they're worried about the integrity of their investments, and they want something that will hold its value. And two of the really most popular vehicles for expressing that view have been gold and oil. But gold and oil are two very different commodities. Oil is certainly by far the largest market. It's by far the most liquid. It's traded and in a number of places globally, but it's used everywhere. It's without the doubt the most important of all the commodities. It's also a resource that is constantly expended. And there is the there is now evidence that a supply response is coming through. And major bull markets end primarily because of a supply response. If we were talking about currencies, it would be because the government was laboring under an uncompetitive situation because its currency had become too strong and would begin printing. That's exactly what we saw with Switzerland only in the last year, where it pegged its currency to the euro. If we were talking about stock markets, you would have a whole slew of IPOs where companies see the price of their companies soar and they wish to secure the most capital possible to ensure their futures. So they sell the company into the stock market. That increases supply. Demand is overwhelmed and prices come back down. And you see that at the top of every stock market bubble. But most people will probably associate that with the Nasdaq bubble. And in the bond markets, when yields drop to historic lows, everyone rushes out to lock in the cheapest cost of capital that they've seen in decades, and supply increases substantially. It will eventually overwhelm demand. And in the commodity markets, when prices go higher, everyone who's involved in the industry and that has access to a resource will look at the rising cost of production and the rising cost at which they can sell it, and when that spread is sufficiently wide, they will increase their supply. And that's exactly what we're seeing in the energy sector right now. Gold, though, is a little bit different, because gold mines are assets where we've seen an incredible amount of investment over the last decade, with mines going from historically low investments in new supply to probably historically high investments in new supply. The market is certainly not overwhelmed with new supply at present. But where gold and something like oil differ is that all of the gold that has ever existed still exists in one form or another today. And it is being soaked up by investors. Whereas this week oil, gold prices have firmed, the ETF holdings for gold hit new highs. And that will be seen by a considerable number of people as a bullish factor. And it certainly is a bullish factor in the short term and potentially the medium term. However, the fact that gold is immutable and that once one owns gold, it isn't going anywhere, suggests that the fact that it is immutable is its great strength, in that it provides people with a high degree of confidence and that they can put their faith in something that where the supply of something cannot simply be printed into existence, and that something that will hold its value. That is seen as its great strength by a large number of people. But what we also need to be aware of, and it offers an excellent example of the of Hegel's master-slave dialectic, is that its greatest strength will also eventually be its greatest weakness, because all of that available all of that supply will eventually overwhelm demand, and then we will move into a new secular bear. Now we ask ourselves, is there any evidence of that right now? And the very quick answer is no, there isn't any evidence that gold's bull market has ended. In fact, it is looking increasingly likely that gold is going to reassert its bull market in the next few months, if or potentially early next year. Gold has been prone to these 18-month consolidations, at least until 2009. It broke upwards in Septembers of uneven years from 2001 through 2009, and then it broke upwards in 2010 and 2011, and it hit a new peak in September of 2011. It's been consolidating since. It found support recently in the region of $1,550 and has rallied by approximately $100. It has moved from the distribution phase of this correction to an accumulation phase. And the evidence that we see of that is that it found support in the region of $1,550 back in May, and it's held a progression of incrementally higher reaction lows since then. It has broken back above its 200-day moving average, and it has a rounding characteristic which is consistent with accumulation. It would suggest that we've gone through the really hairy part of the corrective phase and we're moving into the accumulation part. And if that is the case, then reactions will be buying opportunities for the foreseeable future. Once we see gold starting to take out the $1,700 and then the $1,800 area, then a run up to the highs and onto new high ground will look increasingly likely. And if gold is going higher, then that will act as an anchor for some of the other precious metals who have also firmed in here over the last couple of weeks. So we're in a very interesting phase in the precious metal markets. Gold has posted a positive performance every year for the last decade, and 2012 doesn't appear to be any different. When gold actually stops posting positive performances year in, year out, that will be an inconsistency. That'll at least be a warning that something is changing in the market. So, at present, things are looking very rosy indeed. But as gold continues to move higher, we need to keep in touch with reality and realize that all good things will eventually come to an end. And while there is absolutely no evidence yet that gold is about to end, it will at some point. And the most important thing to remember then is that when one major bull market is ending, another one is beginning. And where there is the greatest potential for a major bull market to end is in government bonds, because we have seen this massive increase in supply and investors have been falling over themselves to accept negative real yields in an effort to secure a momentum trade which has the appearance of offering security. That is unlikely to be a strategy that is going to work beyond the short to medium term. When total return indices start breaking their consistencies and sustaining moves below their 200-day moving averages, we will have clear evidence that the more than 30-year bull market in US Treasuries has ended. And when it has, yield will take on a premium. And anyone holding government bonds that they bought today is going to face a secular decline in the value of their holdings. So what we've seen has been a momentum move in these government bonds. If we take it in and look more short term, we've seen that there's been incredible commonality in government bond futures. The vast majority came right down to test the upper side of underlying trading ranges over the last couple of weeks. They bounced emphatically this week, and they've weakened into the close here on Friday. They will need to hold above last week's lows if even that momentum trade is to be given the benefit of the doubt. It is looking increasingly likely that we are going to have an inflationary issue with the markets generally. Commodity prices have been too high for too long not to see some of that push effect make its way into consumer prices. If one looks at the types of assets that can hold their value in an inflationary environment, then the stock market sticks out as a real candidate, and particularly those shares that have a strong record of increasing their dividends. And for the first time since the 1950s, we are in a situation where the S&P 500, not just high-yielding shares, but the actual broad index, yields more than US Treasuries. Now, prior to the 1950s, that was considered normal because of the risk that was seen to exist in corporations. And investors demanded a higher yield. Whereas today, we're seeing that corporations are incredibly well capitalized. They have reordered their balance sheets in the last few years, and governments have taken on record amounts of debt. And if one were to look at it with an unemotional eye, then high quality equities represent a bargain relative to government bonds in the current situation. So that is something that is likely to be a significant issue over the next number of years. The fact that the S&P has been going sideways for 12 years doesn't make it more bearish. In fact, it makes it more bullish, because when it eventually does break out of this range, then that's likely to be a signal that we're moving into, or at least we're moving out of, a decade-long process of P/E ratio contraction and rising dividend yields, and embarking on potentially a decades-long process of P/E ratio expansion and contracting dividend yields. And we're already starting to see exactly that with a considerable number of globally oriented companies that are leveraged to the growth of the global consumer. And it is those companies that are offering leverage to the big investment theme from an equity perspective, which is the greatest urbanization in history. Hundreds of millions of people being lifted out of poverty into the middle classes, and in, most importantly, into the consuming classes. And I think with that, I will leave you for the evening and wish all the best to all of you.